Donald on the Kitchen talks about foods. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm supposed to read. Ah, here we go. The Donald on the Kitchen is sponsored in part by the Monkey Duck Pub, where pub means community. For information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
We gather here once a week, as I said, on Tuesday. On Tuesday at noon, and this show is live. You would have never guessed. This show is live, and we do it without a net, I tell you. We just kind of dive in and take on food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And what else can we talk about here in Iowa than the weather currently? We have got piles of beautiful, beautiful snow.
And we're about to get piled on again. Are we ready?
We haven't had kind of a pretty winter in a long time. And here it is. There is piles of snow and there's piles of cold.
I'm thinking it's been about 8 years since we've had this kind of pile, right?
A pile. Yes. You know, big piles.
Yeah, where you have to, like, make your little pathways through the snow and go down the same pathway every time because you get another 6 inches.
And more is coming. A little bit of cabin fever. I don't know how things are in your house, Donna, but I've got this cat. Now, this cat can go in and out anytime he wants, and he does. He goes outside and sits on the deck when it's sunny, and then comes back in. But you can tell there's cabin fever because just about the time I'm in bed, I hear this cat wanting something to play with, and he's discovered my little round or little it's just a little plastic garbage can in my bathroom. And you think, okay, yeah, he's going to just kind of
rattle,
look it
rattle,
up.
Rattle.
He puts it on the side and whacks it from one wall to the other. Whacka, 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 whacka. You'd think a cat
that
would
must
have
drive the dog crazy.
It does, and it's usually, you know, late in the evening, and so a little cabin fever here. Oh dear, oh dear. I have a poem to share, and this is a winter poem, and this is a Iowa winter poem. It's from the Iowa poet Michael Carey. He was born in Queens, New York, but he decided to move out here in the prairie, and he lives in southwest Iowa now. And this is a poem about Iowa in winter. It's called A Certain Slant of Light. I always thought snow was white, but Iowa turns blue in its shadow. The hills and the sky and the rivers beneath it lie quiet come winter, heavy as the arms of a departed lover, blue as her puckered lips. And who shall she kiss this morning? The land we rise from? And the catfish dreaming in the pond? The malignant cracking ice on the river, the barren trees, glassy branches. Soon, one noon, we will cast no shadow when the dead rise, when all that is brown is green, when we know what we know, when our bones tell us, when the sun once again fills us, come spring. Yes, it is coming. That is a poem from Michael Carey, from a collection of poems called Nishnabotna. Isn't Nishnabotna just one of the prettiest words? It's a river in southwest Iowa.
It must be a Native American word.
It must be. It probably means river in southwest Iowa. Nishnabotna. There you go. So there was a winter poem to start us out called A Certain Slant
of
Light.
Well, it's true about the light. I mean, one thing, when we have snow like this, it is bright out. Even when the sun doesn't shine, it's hard to be, you know, when things are gloomy and brown, it's like, ugh. But just looking out of the windows, everything's sparkling, and that it's that heavy, clumpy snow, so there's like bobbles on everything.
Bubbles.
All the dried hydrangeas all have hats on them. It's quite beautiful.
It is quite beautiful. Let's enjoy it.
We might as well. We don't really have a choice here.
So today, even though it's winter outside, we want to think about signs of spring. And this last
weekend. We're planning for the certitude of a change in the season.
This last weekend, there was a small gathering of CSA people. Donna, talk about CSA.
Yeah, okay. That is Community Supported Agriculture. So Wheatsfield had a little, they called it the CSA Fair. I want to take my hat off to both Lana and Joe at Onion Creek Farm and to Gary Guthrie and people who have been vegetable farming diligently for at least the last 25 years. Lana, what on earth made you guys start a vegetable farming business?
Oh, goodness. Because I've always gardened. My garden has grown, and since I moved to Iowa,
from Wisconsin,
our garden has grown and grown and grown, and we got to know a lot of nice people that did food and gardening and food and long about mid, oh, the early, actually the early 90s, people were making noises about there's a CSA model, and one of the early CSA models in town was called Magic Beanstalk, and that was kind of the first attempt at getting farmers and food and their customers together. That
well, worked out we really didn't fine. Have farmers markets no, quite not, yet, no, at least not around here.
Well, not hardy ones, no.
No, we did have them in California, and I must say I benefited personally. That just, like, lit my whole brain up. And of course, in Europe, many countries still have that tradition. But we lost it, and now we're bringing it back. So a few intrepid people like Joe and Lana started growing. I mean, did you really intend to grow to sell to other people?
Yes, but I was thinking. I was just thinking. Oh well, put in some sweet corn. We'll just take a load of sweet corn. But it kind of grew and grew, and with
encouragement. I suspect that Lana just has this magic wand, waves it, and the eggplant pop forth, and the okra spring into forests. And
Donna, it looks like that
out there, I must say.
Our farm was not the first farm that grew for magic beanstalk. I remember Mark Harris was one of the first growers. Started
and, farm. And what yeah. sort of things did he grow?
Oh, God, heavens, that was 30 years ago. I can't remember.
Tomatoes, surely,
yeah,
right?
And
basil.
Greens yeah. and radishes and things like that. Yeah, and people were just getting used to ordering things ahead of time. But since then, things have really improved. People understand more about where their food comes from. Farmers markets are booming. And the CSA model is a really nice way of connecting up the eaters with the growers. It gives the farmer a market that he knows.
Because the financial structure, which is what started CSA, mm-hmm. is that everybody buys a share in the spring, and then you just share in the harvest. Whatever you get, you get. Mm-hmm. And if the farmer has a bad year, mm-hmm. he's supported, and you just are kind of putting a little money in the pot for him.
Well, actually, it doesn't even work. It's maybe you don't get as many vegetables of what exactly you wanted, like eggplant. Maybe you get a whole lot of winter squash instead. There's always something growing. Thank goodness the climate is still hanging in there here in central Iowa. You can always grow something, but it is sharing the risk. That's important.
Well, and then the magic beanstalk morphed into farm to folk, which is still running, mm-hmm. and as we've talked about many times on this show, for some very nominal fee, you can be a member, then you get an email on, like, Friday of who's producing what, and this goes all year long, mm-hmm. and then you reply back. So this is, like, They do have shares. You can still buy shares, or you can order a la carte and then say, oh, I want 3 bags of lettuce this week and 2 bags of kale and a big piece of that cheese from, what's Kevin's farm's name?
Lost Lake Farm.
Yeah, so you can buy eggs, you can buy meat, you can buy cheese, you can buy mushrooms, all through Farm to Folk. Now, at the CSA fair, it was kind of a nice assortment. There were, what, maybe 6 or 8 farms that. And you kind of got to see different marketing strategies by different, all local Iowa-grown food. And
there's Farm to Folk was represented there, but there were also farms that are their own CSA. You can do that. Get to know your farmer and get to know things from their farm.
So each one of them kind of had a slightly different option or something like this. Like there was the Raccoon Forks Farm, which is the they raise goat, lamb, mutton, chicken. And then locally grown, chemical free. She says they don't certify, but they do grow organically. So, I mean, when you're talking to the farmer, that's Raccoon Forks.
From Adel, Iowa.
Yeah. Oh, and they also, what did she say? They're related to something called Optimal Life Services. So they
that sounds good.
Well, they use farming as a rehabilitation technique for people that need help.
Oh, very good.
And so that's always a nice thing to contribute to. So you can just Google them, Raccoon Forks Farms. They have. I was interested in the goat, frankly. You don't get a lot of goat around here. Then there's Wabi Sabi Farms, which used to be Angela Tedesco's farm. Isn't that just like west of Des Moines or something?
It's by Granger, the great metropolis
right.
of Granger.
And they market once a week. There's a local pickup in town at somebody's house, so you can have a CSA. With them. Then there's another farmer from Northwest Iowa called Thankful Harvest. So this is mostly so the beef, lamb, chicken, turkey, and eggs. It's all grass-fed. And then he swings through here about, what did he say? He's on every 3 weeks, and he will deliver right to your home.
Ah!
And that is, so he's got a website also, thankfulharvest.com. It says artisan quality, ecological management, small herd husbandry, grass-fed, free home delivery, organic, the works. So that's another one you can look up. That was very interesting model. Backyard Harvest. Which one was that? Okay. Oh, that's the one you were going to talk about. It is located where?
It is located south of Ames in a place called Chautauqua Bottoms Greenbelt, and I never heard of it before. Well, actually, Chautauqua Bottoms Greenbelt is a...
It's not Chautauqua. It's Chautauqua.
Chautauqua, like Chicago. Bottoms Greenbelt. Now, that is a Iowa wildlife area, but she lives down there. She has a farm. It's along the Skunk River in... down by Ankeny. So
she
says
she's farming about an acre and a half.
Yeah, good for her.
Something. Oh, it was called Seven Pines Farm.
Yeah, Seven
right?
Pines
and
Farm.
And they retired, mm-hmm. and they have a new young farmer.
Very
and
good.
She goes, her court says, think local, think global, act local, Backyard Harvest. She says she actually is able to sell into some of the fairway stores around here, too. And she does some farmer's market. And she does foraging, I guess, in the Chautauqua, what's it called?
Bottoms.
So sometimes...
It sounds wet, but probably
yeah, she
not.
She says,
okay.
I just like to tramp through the woods. And so sometimes if you have a CSA share with her, you'll get like lamb's quarters or possibly nettles or something like that.
See?
So that sounds kind of fun. So that's Backyard Harvest. And then also Jessica, can you pronounce her last name? What's it? Heritage.
Krupika.
Heritage Hill. Okay. She is, So Marilyn has retired from Farm to Folk, and Jessica is doing that service for all of us. So she sells at Farm to Folk and will have shares from her farm. So all these different models of younger farmers stepping into the local marketing of direct sales to, you know, it's really nice to buy right from the farmer. You know it was picked. You can ask them how it was grown. You can, you know your farmer. That's what the USDA says. Know your farmer, right?
Oh, I'm glad. So thinking about signs of spring, which will slide into summer, these same folks you can probably find at local farmers markets, too. The idea of buying directly. So eating local means that you could not only get to...
Oh, we didn't mention Lee's Greens was there, too. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to wait till spring. Farm to Folk is operating right now. Of course, it has animal products all year round. Remnant Hills is there, and Lost Lake Farm Cheeses, and the Mushroom Guy, and then Lee's Greens, bless their little hearts. They grow all year round in their high tunnels, so we can have fresh local greens. Now, this is not hydroponic. This is really grown in soil.
Good Iowa dirt.
Yeah, and I don't think I could live through the winter without their lovely baby kales. And this week I'm getting this deep red mustard for my salads. I mean, oh, boy.
Wait, we are lucky. Oh, yeah. And another – actually, this is a new offer as a CSA share. Joy Grow Mushrooms, Aaron Johnson, he was, we talked to him on the Donalana Kitchen kind of late last summer about his mushroom business, and he's going great guns. So Joy Grow Mushrooms is offering shares of mushrooms. That's something you go, you know, every now and then you get a regular supply of really nice
mushrooms. Are really, I mean, if you, you know, if you think of mushrooms and you're thinking of those little button mushrooms that you bought, no. These really have a nice deep flavor. They are delicious.
So think about farming, think about food, and consider a CSA. Look into community supported agriculture. There are a lot of options here in central Iowa. We just mentioned a few. There's some other winter thoughts. Now's the time to check into your freezer, your cold storage, your pantry. Those things you put away last fall.
I'd forgot about.
Right? Some of them may need a little looking over. You know, some things don't make it. And some things you just have. So, there
are options. I dug out a package of soup bones I didn't know I had.
Well, there you go.
I know we're having soup tonight.
It's a great season.
Got the crock pot running. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
It's a great idea for things like that. Because when you get things from CSA or get things from a local farmer, or even when your garden comes in or where your neighbor's garden comes in, you end up with stuff and you put it away. And now's the time to get out those crock pots and soup pots. Time to invite the neighbors in. I'm always, as a vendor at farmers market occasionally in the summer times, we are so rich here. People's biggest problem seems to be, oh, I don't know what to do with all this food. Oh, my goodness, it's going to go bad.
Well, we do live in the midst of some of the richest farmland soil on the planet.
Just think of, if that's what we have to be complaining about, I think we're doing pretty darn good. And here is a radical idea. Make yourself a big pot of soup and invite the neighbors in. You could do that. Even, you know, people would enjoy sitting
around. We have to shovel a path from your house to their house.
That's a good way to get your sidewalk cleared, I tell you. Invite somebody over and have some soup. Share a meal in these cold winter days with some friends, some neighbors. There are certain things that I don't think freeze well. I mean, if I go to the bottom of my freezer and find this package that says, like, 2013 on green beans, they're pretty sad. I throw those away. But there's other things.
I put them in the dog food.
Thank goodness for dogs. I have chickens. When you put
Somebody gets it.
Some things do get freezer burned, especially vegetables. You got to be kind of careful for that. But most things, they lead, all these frozen packages, they're like treasures. They lead to all good things. I want to mention, I had
She's looking for something, but I don't know what it is. What did you want to talk about?
Onion jam.
Oh, Lana makes the best onion jam because, of course, she starts with really good onions that they grow.
Now, I talked about onion jam at a previous show because Donna let me use this recipe book called The River Cottage Handbook Number 2, Preserves by Pam Corbin.
Oh, right. She does make great jellies. We have a couple of really good... Lana and I have two favorite jelly books. There's the French one and the English one.
Yeah. And this one from England, it had a recipe for onion marmalade. And I thought, well, that sounds good, onion marmalade, because jams and jellies don't always have to be sweet. It's sweet.
It's sweet, you could eat it on your toasted breakfast. But you can do other things
savory.
With it.
It's a savory.
Yeah.
And I bring it up this time of year because there's two times of year when onions kind of need going over and helping. One is at the end of the harvest, there's always some onions. And because I grow a lot of onions, there's always this pile of onions that are kind of less than perfect from the summer harvest.
They won't make it into the storage.
They've got a ding in them, or their top did not dry down, and they're just not going to make it. Or, again, that happens late in the winter. I have some good storage onions. I do store onions.
Yeah, and about now, you really got to go through the bin, because they'll have some with oogie spots on them, and if you don't take them out, they will make the whole thing go off.
Right. I think they notice that it's going to be spring one of these months, and they're kind of putting up little green shoots or getting a little soft, and they will taint the rest of the bin. So now's another time you end up with less than perfect onions, and I had a kind of a pile of onions, and it's a good use for onion jam, because even if there's a bad spot on an onion, or even if there's a little green shoot coming up through the middle, you can use the rest of the onion. And I've been kind
of... And the jam is a way to use a whole lot of them all at once.
Yes. I modified this onion marmalade recipe to onion jam because it's more of a Midwestern thing. One of the ingredients that the English recipe calls for was currant jelly added. It adds for an 8-ounce jar of jelly to be added, and you cook it down. That's kind of the sweet that you add to the onion.
Oh, instead of sugar.
But there's a little bit of sugar in there. But still, it's the jam that is added, or the jelly that's added. And they must have a lot more currants in England. I have much more access to apple jellies and crab apple jellies, so I use crab apple jellies in mine, because if I pick currants, I'm going to make currant jelly for myself, thank you. I'm not going to dump it into my onion jam. So I modified this, and also the English recipe was milliliters and ounces and pints, and oh goodness, it just was totally, totally confusing. So I've been playing around with this for a while. The recipe says 2 to 3 tablespoons of olive oil and 5 to 6 pounds of onions sliced thin. You saute those onions very slowly until they are soft and translucent, and don't let them burn. Then you add 1/2 cup sugar, 8-ounce jar of crab apple jelly or other tart jelly, any kind you like, and you cook that down a bit more quick. It takes a while.
Are you using that fabulous jam pan that you have?
I don't use it for the frying of the onions, I dump it into my Maslin pan, but you don't necessarily have to do it, because the idea is getting rid of water.
Right, but you do need a thick bottom pan.
It takes a while. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to stand there and kind of poke at it, because I'm sure that helps too. Then you add 1/2 cup of cider vinegar, 2 ounces of balsamic vinegar, 1 teaspoon of salt, and 1/2 teaspoon of peppercorns. To taste. And cook it down until it becomes gooey. This takes a while. Stir often. Then you can just store this in glass containers in the refrigerator, or you can process it like you're making jelly.
You can hot pack it, too.
You can hot pack it, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's great on a cheese board. It's really good with a little pork chop or a, you know, nice sautéed chicken thigh. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of things with it.
This will end up on the Donna Lana Kitchen website on the recipe page. I've been kind of fooling around with proportions here. I think I got it right this time, folks. So onion jam will be on the Donalana Kitchen website. That's
are you selling that through Farm to Folk, too, or you didn't make enough of it?
I don't make enough of it, really. I kind of give it away for Christmas.
I've been the lucky recipient of this sometimes.
Onion jam, yes, it is. You listen to KHOI. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is a time of year to think of spring. It still looks like winter, but think of spring. It's time to think of dirt and garden and seed catalogs. From the Donalana Kitchen archives, I kind of went back there and kind of like diving into the freezer, diving into the pantry.
We've got five years of shows there. We've talked about a lot of things.
Here's a little segment about herbs and thinking ahead to the garden. Thank you. Herb of the week. I brought a show and tell into the show today, and I'll hold it up to the microphone so everybody can see it. It's called a garland chrysanthemum or an edible chrysanthemum, and it is a green. It's a lovely green. It's easy to grow.
So this is not a wild plant?
No. I suppose it grows in the wild someplace, but not here. I plant it along with my cilantro.
And it's an annual, right?
It's an annual, as far as I know. The seeds are readily available if you look for garland chrysanthemum or edible chrysanthemum. It's known as shinginku in Japan. In Chinatown, it's used as choy soy green. And in England, it's known as crown daisies. It looks very daisy-like. It grows about...
Except it's yellow, not white.
2 to 3 feet tall. The inside of them is yellow. And the leaves, the flowers are edible for those that like edible flowers. But the leaves are pretty lovely. Garland chrysanthemum
has a
slightly mustardy flavor, kind of a floral mustardy flavor and a crispy
texture. No heat.
It's used in Korean, Cantonese, Japanese cuisines. It's a nice handy thing to have in your garden as you're going out there getting yourself a salad for supper. Just break off some and put it in your salad. Although in Asian cuisines, often used in stir fries, casserole dishes, flavor soups, stews, and hot pots. And in the Mediterranean, they tend to use it more as a green. And this amazing little plant has all kinds of antioxidant protection. It's used to encourage weight loss. It protects against cardiovascular problems, kidney stones, cellulite, bloating, and bone loss. It has many antioxidant benefits. It is extremely high in potassium, a lot higher than bananas, pound for pound. Not that you're going to eat a whole pound of it, but it's amazingly high in potassium. It protects against lung cancer. It's been used that way in Asian communities for a long time. It is botanically known as Chrysanthemum coronarium. So look for this chrysanthemum. It's a very nice thing to add to one or two green anything. And it's a pretty thing.
Wow.
So,
That's impressive.
Yeah, there you go.
And the leaves, you can see by looking at it that it's in the chrysanthemum family, but they're kind of smaller and frillier and more tender than the sort of plant that you think of, like, which for some reason, for me, chrysanthemum plants are funereal. I don't know why. But it's good, huh?
It is very good.
Yeah.
And it is pretty hardy, even during the hot weather. It eventually does bolt, and the leaves get a little bitter along about July. But plant them again, because they come up pretty well.
Oh, you can do two plantings
in
a season?
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, they're hardy little things.
Okay, well, the plant I want to talk about this week is the black currant leaf. Not the berry, but the leaf. My neighbor, Ingrid Anderson, who is Swedish, is always introducing me to these things, especially around midsummer or midsommar, as they say. It's a big Swedish celebration.
Which is coming up next week.
Yeah, summer weekend,
solstice.
Isn't it?
Summer solstice.
Summer solstice. Summer solstice is like, I think of it as a, you know, it's a highlight, it's a big fun day, but it's also, it's the longest day of the year, which means that every day after that, the days get shorter. So it's kind of like, I have mixed feelings about the day. It's like, oh, it's a sign that winter is coming again.
Well, you're much too morose. There's a lot of summer ahead of us yet.
Well, I know, but, you know, I love the long days. So anyway, so Ingrid gave me this recipe. It's sort of an aquavit thing. She calls it Fritolfsen's Svart Vinbar's Uch Citron Snaps. How about that?
You just made that whole thing up. I know you did.
No, she's got it written out here. Right, we're going to give you the recipe. But basically, you take vodka and you, she's got a pint of vodka, 1/2 cup of black currant leaves. She picks the little ones, the more tender ones.
And not the red currant leaves.
No, not red currants. It tastes different.
Okay.
So it's the black. And I really experimented because I have both plants in my yard. So I went out and I ate a red currant leaf and I ate a black currant leaf. And, you know, man, these Swedes know what they're doing. They've probably been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you take the 1/2 cup of black currant leaves, the tender young ones, no berries, though the berries will be here soon. But right now they're still green. And you put that into the vodka. And she did say she packs the 1/2 cup, not tightly, but not loosely. So, you know, we decided the more the merrier anyway. So don't stint on the black currant leaves. And then she puts, and this is optional, strips of the yellow-only peel of the lemon. You can put that in or not. And a tiny bit of sugar. So for a pint of vodka, that's 1/2 cup of black currant leaves. And she says she puts 1/4 of a lemon's of the peel only. Okay. And 1/2 teaspoon of sugar. So very, you know, this is not sweet. So she made it, and we tasted it last night. And I'm telling you, it was out of this world.
Sounds like a nice way to say hello to the solstice.
Yes, and she served it with, of course, the traditional very salty herring. So you have this refreshingly herbaceous, very potent tonic of vodka, and then you have some of the salty herring, and it was a great combination. So we'll she says in the recipe, let it sit over a day, strain and cool before serving. But she had let this sit 5 or 6 days, and it had a beautiful light green color. And she and I concluded that we are going to make some more batches and let it sit even longer and see what happens. And then her husband, Walter, had a really good idea that maybe once the black currants are ripe, we should drop a few of that into the mix and see. Now, you know, black currants are not sweet. They're very tart, so it could be quite interesting.
Well, thank you.
So yum yum.
Two good herbs for the week. It's good.
Yep, we got some good herb information today.
Good. That was a bit of wit and wisdom there from our archives talking about herbs of the week.
Summer solstice.
Yes, it was from a show. Well, actually, that was from a summer show from the year 2017. Yeah, we've been doing this a while. So that was some good things to think about. The garden is going to be available to us one of these days. Someday the snow will melt.
And in the meantime, we've got these vials in the pantry of vodka flavored with leaves and things like that.
It's important to label this stuff because things can look kind of strange.
I have a shiso one that's sitting there that was really shiso and vodka. And then I still have plenty of tarragon vinegar left from last summer, too. Lots of good stuff.
Isn't it nice to have those pantry shelves full? Very good. Something that goes on this time of year is seed catalogs. I just love
dreaming of
and planning what I'm growing.
Well, and the days are getting longer.
Yeah. And so I get all of these great seed catalogs, and I always like to try something new. I grow seedlings. I grow tomato seedlings for people, and people actually, we are pretty much traditionalists. Everybody likes their traditional tomatoes, but I always like to try something new, and heaven forbid people are...
All right, how many varieties do you think you're going to do this year, Lana?
Oh, probably about 20.
How modest of you. Some years she goes up to 30.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying right now.
Isn't finished.
Oh, we're not finished yet, but that's what I've got.
So what are the newbies for the experiments,
as it were? Okay, here is an interesting one that is showing up in more than one seed catalog, but I've ordered some of these.
They kind of come in fashions, don't they?
Oh,
right?
They trends. Come in fashions all the time. Yes, they do. There is a new – I wouldn't think – tomatoes would be in fashion, but there is a new thing hot on the market. There's one called mint julep.
Oh, it looks gorgeous. Is that it's a little plum tomato.
It's a little pear-shaped tomato. Now, see, they sell these along with beautiful pictures, these seed catalogs.
So this one is kind of green with little yellow tips.
Yeah.
Speckledy.
It's green and yellow speckled. It is...
Is it a cherry tomato?
Well, no, I would call it a pear tomato, probably bigger than a
So is it billed as a saucing tomato, or it's just got that shape?
No, it's more of a salad tomato.
Okay.
It's called mint julep.
All right, you're not going to tell me that they're growing tomatoes that taste like mint.
No.
Maybe it goes with mint.
You expect too much here. This is mint julep, because it's green. It's a unique plum/pear-shaped 1.5-ounce fruit. It's not very big. Have a pleasant tomato taste with nice overall sweet flavor. It's less tart than other green tomato varieties. It's supposed to be of course, it promises high yield, and everybody will be impressed. And anyway, that's called mint julep. And also, it is also called Michael Pollan tomato. I don't know why, but I've run across it in a couple.
Well, he must have recommended it
must have. And this tomato variety was introduced by Brad Gates from Riled Boar Farm. Say where it is.
Must be in California.
Yeah, right.
In the Berkeley area, right?
Sure. Anyway, some people get a real thrill out of coming out with new tomatoes. And I'm going to try this mint julep and see what we can come up with. Yeah.
Also, so long about July, we'll get a report back. Okay.
We'll get a report. Mint julep. And no, I don't think I'll put it into a drink. No, I don't. Anyway, there's another variety I was going to try, and this was from the Fedco catalog. Fedco is a wonderful collection of vegetables coming out of Maine. There's people up there that have nothing else to do in the winter but make this great catalog and offer all sorts of good stuff. It's an orange paste tomato. So I'm kind of looking forward to
that. So that's for sauce.
It's orange. It's orange. Why not? Why not try that? It's just called an orange paste tomato.
Oh, I bet it'll be beautiful.
Yeah. And here's another one. I thought that this would be good to try.
Do some of them say extraordinary flavor or something like
course.
That? Or you're just picking the pretty girls?
I go by the pictures, actually. No, I read it. I try to be good about it. And also deciding if I should get a determinate, a short vine, an indeterminate, a tall vine. Okay. Here's the general gist. If anybody else is looking through seed catalogs, when a tomato says determinate, D-E-T behind it, it means that the vine stays relatively short, as in just in a tomato cage. When it says indeterminate, that means the vine keeps on growing and growing. And
goes
really
all over the place.
Long. The advantage of a determinate is that generally the fruit sets all at once, or all at once, within a couple of weeks. If you want to have lots of fruit.
Oh, so they don't keep going and going.
But the indeterminate, they keep setting fruit, setting fruit, setting fruit. You don't get as much all at once from a
So if you were having, like, just a kitchen garden, you'd probably want the indeterminate ones, so you could run out over several months and pick a few every...
Pick one of each, because you might want to have a bunch to dry or can or deal. Or do you want to keep eating, put in some that you would harvest all year or all season, you know, mid-season into the fall. So that's the difference, determinate, indeterminate. There you go. Oh, and another. Here, I had to try this one. It's called... mushroom basket.
Now, it's the Costoluta Constantinos, those lobed ones.
Lobes.
Oh, beautiful.
As in, here's this tomato that's like ruffly.
And they're beautiful.
They're beautiful. And they look, just because it says basket, a tomato that says mushroom basket on it, I just thought I'd give that one a try.
Nothing to do with mushrooms.
No. I don't think
so. No, but they are really pretty.
And they're pinkish, not red. Grab lots of attention. Pleated fruits. If they pleated fruits. And that is an indeterminate. So it's just plain fun to look into varieties of stuff. I order from lots of different catalogs. If you're really into tomatoes and peppers too, they have lots of. There is a seed catalog called Totally Tomatoes, and that it comes from a little town called in Randolph, Wisconsin, Totally Tomatoes. You can Google. And they specialize in tomatoes. And also, if you want to try some new stuff, it's a fun catalog to look through. I enjoy it. That's where I found those mint julep green-yellow pears. And we're going to have a report later on exactly what those taste like.
I want to know your opinion on this. A number of years ago, the sort of the main gardener from Seed Savers, I can't even remember where we were, but it was some conference, and I was saying to him, you know, a lot of the heirloom tomatoes, quote heirloom, like the Cherokee Purples and stuff like that, that I used to taste in California, of course we grow them here, they don't taste as good here, right? So I said to him, why is this? It's the same seed. He said that the tomatoes, and this is from Seed Savers, that are more of Russian and Northern Germanic heritage will do better in this climate and deliver you that full flavor that you want.
Yes. Tomatoes, they respond. They respond to day length. They respond to soil. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are a number of
We do have great
varieties.
Soil here, but we don't have a long growing season.
So try lots of tomatoes. Some tomato may like your backyard a lot more than another tomato. So try one. And a Russian tomato would be maybe a black crim or a black from Tula.
You've done those, and what do you think?
They are actually do very well, and they, because they're shorter to ripen, they actually come pretty early. Some of them don't do as well, and some of them do. I've had luck with crims, and I'm trying one this year called Black Prince. That is also a Northern European, Eastern European. We shall see. It's always an adventure. Always an adventure. So, you're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you want to find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen, go to khoifm.org. Go to the talk section. Go to the Donna Lana Kitchen pages there, and you can find lots of past shows. You can find recipes, and I'll even have this onion jam recipe up on there, and it's got all things you can look at. And also, look around, because khoifm.org has got lots of other great locally produced shows. This is a good place to spend your time, good place to put your ears. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about winter and spring today, looking out the window at winter and looking ahead to spring. Along with spring comes insects, and I'm afraid there's some bad news. We kind of like to keep track of what's going on, and the Donalana Kitchen News Department is full of things. This is not some such not so good news. So, Donna, what do you have for us today?
Well, in The Guardian, recently there was an article about plummeting insect numbers threaten the collapse of nature. So, you know, we think of, oh, right, there's not so many mosquitoes, or, the, you know, who needs those mosquitoes anyway? Well, it seems that insects are the most varied and abundant animals on the planet. They outweigh humanity, outweighing per weight of all those little insects by 17 times, right?
Now, I get your mind around that.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Of course, there's a lot of people, so there's even more insects, right? They are essential for the proper functioning of all ecosystems, and they are, you know, the thing is, when you lose the insects, there are cascading consequences. Now, of course, why is this happening? Well, the main number one reason is pesticides.
Oh, for goodness.
And that we all know, living in the agricultural community that we do, that large amounts of herbicides and pesticides are used. So we're losing 2.5% a year, which is rather shocking. That means in 10 years, you've lost 25% of your insects, right?
Yeah.
In 50 years, you know, do the math, you'll lose half of them. And in 100 years, you'll have none. So we really need to reverse this cascade.
We're talking about climate change and all these things that happen. It could kind of all be related. And this kind
of... Well, there's habitat loss.
In
the tropics and other regions of the planet where we haven't used so many pesticides, there is enough of a change in the temperature that the insects in those regions are becoming unstable because they're very fixed in the kind of temperature range that they can handle.
Oh, for goodness sakes. See, it's one of these things that, well, we can just put our earbuds in and turn up the music and just forget it, or this is kind of important. And since we talk about food here on the Donalana Kitchen, we thought it was pretty important, yes.
Well, he says, the author of the study, of course, says that it's, you know, habitat loss. And he's describing also about the pesticides and the insecticides. Says they sterilize the soil, killing all of the grubs. It kills everything in the soil as well. I mean, there's insects in the soil that, you know, we don't even see, we don't even think about.
That's maybe where some of that weight comes from. There's a lot of stuff underneath our feet. Yes, there is.
Also habitat loss, you know, because now we do just oceans and oceans of the same, corn and soybeans, frankly,
soybeans.
I mean, when we worry about the agricultural... this is our local issue is water contamination and water quality. And, of course, that has to do somewhat with, you know, nitrogen fertilizer runoff. But it also has to do with all the other things we're putting in the fields. So we may be looking at water quality, but we do need to also get serious about this insect loss. And this, according to the study, if we don't change our way of farming – dum, da, dum, da, dum. Okay, this is not good news. Not good news. He said he thinks that the new classes of insecticides introduced in the last 20 years, including the neonicotinoids and the fipronil, I don't know which one that one, have been particularly damaging as they are used routinely and persist in the environment.
Yeah, we also run across news about pollinators. I mean, after all, we're talking food here on
right.
this show.
It says mostly the hardest hit have been the bees and the moths.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I know.
And we won't get some of these things like tomatoes and especially fruits and nuts.
I don't know, Lana, do you think you could just go around and hand pollinate if you have to?
No.
Touch every little blossom with some Q-tip covered with pollen and...
Unfortunately, I don't have the wisdom of a honeybee to know which end is up. I mean, even that. And
well, if we got it a lot smarter and, you know, we could solve this. But there are easier ways to do it and is by using different agricultural techniques. It is not impossible.
Heads up, folks. We're talking our food, we're talking our crops, and we're talking the future. Another thing that article mentioned, and I've run across this before, is we didn't seem to notice, but all of a sudden, driving around Iowa in the summer, we don't have windshields full of squashed insects anymore. Mm-hmm. Where did they go? And should we worry? Yes.
Yeah,
yes, we should.
And if you look at, so they make these nice maps that show where the insecticides are spread the most heavily.
Oh, dear.
And the area of Iowa, let me tell you, it is densely affected. Oh. This is our issue. This is not someplace else on the planet. It's right here.
Ooh. So, not such good news from the Donalana Kitchen News Department.
It's a wake up. Wake up. Come on.
It's something we need to know. Well, it's still winter, and we are looking forward to spring. Now's the time of year to think of your food supply and find yourself a farmer. Look into community-supported agriculture and also look into farmers markets, which will be coming up. Think of eating locally.
And look into the depths of your freezer and get it organized there.
Get it organized. If the worst problem that we have is, oh, I don't know what to do with all this food. Despite everything, I think we're doing pretty good. Share. Make a nice pot of soup.
And waste not, want not.
Yes. I want to take a little bit of time to do a small salute to a really fine woman who has been part of the Ames Public Library for 36 years. Lynn Carey is retiring. That's part of the riches of our community, a really fine library. Thanks to Lynn Carey.
Yes, and we should say that Lynn has agreed to join the board of our wonderful radio station.
And we will appreciate
She just can't do enough for this community, can't
very
she?
Very good.
Thank you, Lynn.
You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can listen Tuesday at noon. It's repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m. or anytime at khoifm.org. You can find archives. You can find recipes. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. A fine, actually speaking of eating local, you can listen local to, and you can dance local to the Barn Owl Band. There's a barn dance this weekend. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We've been at Excellent Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.